From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, an actor who has great legs and isn't afraid to use them. We talk with Charles Bush about why dressing in drag freed him as an actor. Bush has written and starred in plays spoofing and paying homage to Hollywood. His Vampire Lesbians of Sodom was Off-Broadway's longest-running hit. He's performing a new one-person show called Flipping My Wig. Also, a father's plan to get a new son after learning that the one he has is gay. It's the story of a family that was torn apart by the son's homosexuality. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. A new letter bomb was discovered today at a post office in Kansas. It was addressed to a parole officer at Leavenworth, as were two previous devices. In all, 8 similar letter bombs have been found in the last 2 days. The FBI is looking into possible connections between the bombs sent to Leavenworth and those mailed to the Washington Bureau of an Arabic newspaper. Investigators are checking the inmate population at the federal prison, which includes a man convicted in the World Trade Center bombing. Europe remains in the grip of record-breaking cold weather today. From London, NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
The deep freeze, which has caused more than 200 deaths around the continent, is now in its second week. Temperatures in the single digits are causing travel chaos. In France, 12,000 train travelers returning from the New Year's holiday were stranded in the Rhone River Valley as the freezing conditions caused power lines to snap. In Marseille, on the Mediterranean coast, where temperatures at this time of year are usually in the 50s, crews were scraping ice 4 inches thick off railway power lines. In Britain, country roads were shut down by ice and drifting snow, and the River Thames west of London froze over for the first time in 50 years. In the Netherlands, a zoo brought its penguins inside and warmed them up by placing them in a cooler with a constant temperature of 41 degrees. Forecasters say the cold will last through the weekend. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
The Bosnian parliament has convened for the first time since it was elected more than 3 months ago. The meetings are meant to pave the way for the government to function fully for the first time since the war began. The BBC's Karen Coleman reports from Sarajevo.
The House of Representatives that finally met today in Sarajevo is one of two assembly bodies that will be responsible for governing the whole country. The other is the House of Peoples, which will also meet later on in the day. The Serb, Croat and Muslim members of the assembly were all packed tightly together in a small room at the city's National Museum. They approved a newly nominated Council of Ministers, along with the cabinet's two leaders, effectively establishing the government responsible for the whole country. It's a hugely significant event because finally it means Serbs, Muslims and Croats are working together in a joint parliament. For weeks, the Bosnian Serbs had refused to participate, citing reasons such as venue locations and timings as obstacles to cooperation. But earlier this week, they relented and agreed to get together with fellow Muslim and Croat parliamentarians.
The BBC's Karen Coleman. President Clinton has extended for 6 months his suspension of a new law that would allow U.S. citizens to sue foreign companies doing business in Cuba on property confiscated from Americans. The law, which was enacted last spring, enraged Europeans, Canadians, and Mexicans who argued that the U.S. was trying to impose its own anti-Cuban trade sanctions on them. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up over 85 points. This is NPR News. And now in NPR's business update, stock prices were higher right from the start today. Not only is the Dow up, but the Nasdaq Composite Index is 19 points higher on the strength of a rally in technology stocks. More from NPR's Jim Zaroli in New York.
Stocks began to rise shortly after the opening and then continued to go up throughout the morning. By 10:30, the Dow was up more than 50 points, triggering the market's ban on computerized trading. Among blue-chip stocks, Caterpillar, General Electric, and United Technologies were all up. IBM rose sharply, pushing up the value of other technology stocks, including Compaq and Dell Computer. Analysts say the market is still rebounding from yesterday, when it fell 95 points but recovered almost all of its losses by mid-afternoon. Today's rise also came after a report showing that construction spending was higher than expected in November. This is Jim Zaroli in New York.
Financially struggling Air France will cut costs by 15% over the next 3 years in an effort to stay competitive with its European rivals. The new cuts come on top of a 20% reduction in the previous three-year period. Chrysler Corporation says it capped a record sales year with its best December ever. Chrysler sold 2.4 million cars, trucks, and minivans last year. The company says it expects to see continued growth in its market share in the new year. Honda has unveiled an electric car model to be sold in Southern California. The EV Plus, as it's called, is a battery-operated four-seat compact with a range of about 100 miles per charge. It will sell for about $54,000, or it may be leased for about $500 a month. It goes on sale in May. The announcement follows last year's debut of General Motors' two-seat EV1 car. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for this program comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting public understanding of the changing relationship between family and workplace.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Charles Bush discovered who he was as an actor when he became a leading lady. He now writes and stars in gender-bending plays that are both tributes to and send-ups of Hollywood and cabaret. His Vampire Lesbians of Sodom was the longest-running play in off-Broadway history. His Psycho Beach Party spoofed two Sally Field roles. He starred as a teenage girl who wants to be a surfer but suffers from multiple personality disorder. The lady in question was a melodrama set in the 40s. New York Times critic Frank Rich described Bush's performance as a walking anthology of feminine Hollywood legends. On this archive edition, we have a 1993 interview with Bush, but first, a look at his latest one-person show called Flipping My Wig, which he's currently performing in Manhattan. One of the characters he does is Miriam Passman, an older woman from a wealthy New York suburb who has taken up cabaret singing now that her children are grown. Her act includes a tribute to Edith Piaf.
I am not Edith Piaf. My name is Miriam Passman. This is not an impersonation, but rather a tribute to the little sparrow of Paris. All my life, I have been consumed by a passion for everything and all things French. Indeed, as many of you out here know, I am a teacher of French language studies at the Scarsdale school system.
I grew up in Westchester, and I've always been so amused and fascinated by these very rather over-articulate, rather raging Jewish suburban women who I'm rather proud of. So Miriam Passman is a woman who, now that her children have grown, she's finally expressing herself and doing her nightclub act in a little club in the village. Because in New York, there's kind of an epidemic of housewife divas, and they're all doing acts, which is kind of cool.
There was an excerpt of a report by WHYY's Elizabeth Blair on Bush's recent triad performance in Philadelphia. In 1993, Charles Bush told me that he didn't find himself as an actor until he put on lashes and heels. I wanted to know what dressing in drag brings out in him.
Well, what it initially brought out in me was a whole sense of freedom and expression that I didn't have. It was a rather liberating experience for me at first. I think things have sort of changed as I've kind of grown up, become maybe more comfortable with myself. But when I started out, I used to do a one-man show for years that I booked around the country called Charles Bush Alone with a Cast of Thousands. And at the time, I wasn't in drag. I would be just kind of in black pants and a shirt, and I played many different characters, and it would be kind of a narrative where I would have to play every character that, you know, that I needed in that particular story. And so often there'd be male roles that just weren't really right for me, and I didn't think I was really very good at, and I thought I was rather stiff. And somehow the female characters seemed the more fun. You know, often women can just be, in our society, can be more flamboyant, more expressive at times. So I enjoyed that. And then when I started performing with my theater company in the East Village in the 80s, I decided just to put on, you know, this outrageous drag outfit. We really thought it was just going to be for a weekend. Little did I know it would be my career. But it was a very liberating experience. And I wasn't, for the first time, I wasn't thinking about, oh, what do I do with my hands? It just somehow it came very natural. The interesting thing I find now, though, thousands of performances later and thousands of pairs of eyelashes later, that what was so liberating is beginning to feel a little confining, and I'm actually ready to de-drag for a while, to be a fella, because it just, after all this time, I've been doing it since 84, sometimes it feels a little bit just confining to have my creativity always filtered through this sort of female persona.
What do you think the difference is between what you're doing on stage and what more traditional female impersonators have done? The female impersonators who specialize in Betty Davis and Judy Garland, Barbara Streisand. Mm-hmm.
Well, because they are doing specific people, and I do different characters that are sort of my own invention. Although sometimes I kind of
do a little Judy.
Or if I'm doing, like, at one point in the show, I do this old movie sketch, and I kind of slip into a little Betty Davis at times just to kind of punctuate the line, or a little Susan Hayward. But it's basically my own character, I like to think.
But it also seems to me that you're more consciously gender-bending than a lot of your predecessors.
Yeah. But I sort of straddle the fence in many ways. It seems that you can sort of divide female impersonators into two groups. Generally, those who are comedians and are pretty, kind of outrageous looking and somewhat maybe even grotesque, but are very funny. And then there are other female impersonators who go to great lengths to create this perfect illusion of beautiful femininity, and often they kind of lip-sync to songs but I'm sort of in the middle, because I'm a comedian, but I look kind of good in those gowns. My legs ain't bad, so I think, so I'm sort of in the middle. And I must say, too, I've kind of lost any bit of integrity I may have had. Or I used to go to great pains where when I would do shows, that I never wore falsies, that I wasn't really trying to convince the audience of an illusion. I was just kind of giving the notion of a general idea. But I don't know. Maybe it's just I've gotten older. But I'm so padded up. I think I've got two editions of the Sunday Times in each hip. My God. I go to great pains now to look very lovely. So I'm very careful about the lighting. So I don't know what that is. Maybe it's just the more you do it, the more you kind of get into it.
Some drag queens object to feminism because it's not feminine enough, and really some drag queens really believe in traditional gender roles.
Yeah, I would think so. Isn't it interesting? And yet, I guess, I was raised in a largely female household with two sisters that I'm very close to, and so the issues of feminism have always been rather real to me. And so I have always kind of prided myself that the female characters in my plays are sort of feminist role models. I always sort of played the career woman, battling that devil man who's you can't trust him. So I've kind of liked it, and I seems like I have a female following. I think there's, always going to be somebody who's upset by something you do, and I'm sure, some women might just find the whole notion of drag just offensive, and no matter what you do, even if I did the Kate Millett story, they wouldn't like it, But in my heart, I know that I respect women, and I love the kind of women that I admire, so are such strong women.
For our listeners who haven't seen your shows, let me ask you to say a couple of words about a couple of your shows.
Okay.
Let's start with Vampire Lesbians of Sodom.
Those are four big words. Strong words. But we had, a hard time, when that show first started in 80, we started in 84, we moved it commercially in 85, and the New York Times wouldn't print the name in the ad.
Really?
Yeah, and I wondered, I thought, it must be, I think if the play was called The Lesbian, they would have printed it if it was called Vampires or even if it was called Sodom. But you put them together and, oh boy, you know, head for the hills.
So tell us what it was about.
Well, it was kind of like a series of vaudeville sketches more than a play. And I played a lovely virgin sacrifice in ancient Sodom who is bit by the very glamorous succubus creature. This kind of Mae Westian vampirist, and she, the virgin sacrifice, because of this bite, becomes a vampire too, and so the two of them are kind of in a race across time as they go through various centuries trying to steal each other's thunder. And kind of the joke of it was that they were both, after they left Sodom, they both were in show business. And so we saw them in Hollywood in the 20s where they were vamps and silent films, and then in Las Vegas today, and they're still at it. So it was, you know, it was a cute show. And what I liked about it, too, is that underneath all the very silly campiness, it kind of, I thought it had a little something to say about relationships, and I think that many of us have friends or even, you know, relatives who could just drive us crazy and you'd like to murder at times, but if they weren't around, we'd certainly miss them.
Well, what was the very first time you dressed in drag?
Let's see. Well, I think when I was about 9, I think Bobby Fitzpatrick next door wanted us to put on his mother's evening gown. But other than that, it was many years later. I was in college and just dressing up for Halloween. But I learned really right away. It occurred to me that I got kind of bored when I just put on the dress and makeup and everything got all rigged up. Just as an end to itself, it just, I got kind of restless and sort of tired too. You just kind of want to spread your legs and, you know, and relax, you know. And I needed to have the role. It's, for me, drag is so connected with the theater that I can't separate it. That as soon as I, like for instance, we had a float in the gay parade this year, and I put together this outfit to I mixed and matched, and but this at this point I certainly can. I've got probably more clothes than you have. I mean, I've a lot of dresses for every occasion. You know, if you need.
I'm
anything.
Sure you have more heels than I do.
Yeah, well, call me. You know, and anyway, so I put together this outfit to wear. You know, in this open car. And as soon as I put it on, though, my mind was just racing so quickly. I was Melina McCrory in Never on Sunday. 5 seconds later, no, I'm Audrey Hepburn in a 60s caper film. Oh no! And it was so dizzying that I finally was just getting like hyperventilating just because of the images in my head of the different roles that I could play in that costume. So it wasn't enough just to be, you know, don't I look swell in this lovely couture creation.
You know, it's really funny. I feel like I should ask you for tips about how to walk in high heels. I've never been able to wear heels.
Really? It's so simple.
not that I'm dying to wear them or anything, but my feet ache and I figure it's not worth it. So you want to give me some tips?
Oh, I could run the decathlon in it. I could. You know, talk about drag racing. I mean, I could really. I walk better in heels, I think, than in flats somehow. I've fallen arches, kind of. I think the heels help me. But, I don't know, you just sort of balance yourself, and I took to it like a duck to water. You know, I never quite understood when you see movies like Tootsie where the guys get in heels and they're wobbling all over the place, and I know, I guess, you know, it's for comic effect, but I never found it so tricky.
Actor and writer Charles Bush is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring a 1993 interview with Charles Bush. He's performing his new show, Flipping My Wig, in Manhattan. Did dressing in drag or doing theater in drag coincide at all with figuring out your sexual identity?
In a certain sense, it did. In just that, when I was in college, I was coming out gay, and I came out gay with a sledgehammer. I mean, I was just, you know, out. Awful, you know. Just outrageous. My best friend and we just, you know, it was sort of during the height of kind of the David Bowie sort of, you know, glitter rock period. We had red hair and, you know, eyeliner on, and I had just awful big fun fur, this big fur coat on. I thought I looked like Maria Schneider in Les Tango Paris, but I don't know if everyone else shared that opinion. But anyway, at the same time, I'm taking these acting classes, and the roles that you would work on in class would be like, you know, Bo and Bus Stop or Biff and Death of the Salesman, and I just did not identify at all. And they're just so, there are no roles to that or anything, you know, and particularly like in college, we would be in a, it was kind of a method sort of, you know, Stanislavski approach where you're supposed to be using elements of your own, you know, past and your emotions. And it was very hard for me to identify. And so consequently, there were like no roles that I even wanted to play. And I was really tormented because I was obsessed with acting and all my life wanted to be an actor. And I thought, well, if there are no roles in the repertoire that I am desperate to play, what's the point, you know? And I thought, I could be the boy in Equus, but there are many other fellas who could play it a lot better or just as well. I wanted to be special. I wanted to be unique. And I always wrote. And then I was always kind of improvising different characters for my friends. And I had a friend who said, well, this is who you are. This is what you should do. And it took me a while to really realized that was the case, and that what I really loved was writing the story and telling it myself.
Did you actually make it onto the stage in roles that you didn't identify with when you were trying to?
I usually never got them. Uh-huh. I usually wasn't cast because they're, you know, someone else who was more comfortable with it. I was uncomfortable with my masculinity, and in a way, I think now, after all these years doing drag, for some reason now I feel just more at ease with myself and ready to you know, go from leading lady to juvenile. a leap, isn't it? Unique one. And also, I tell you the truth, you know, there's so much drag around nowadays. I like to think that maybe I helped pave the way. Of course, I was helped by Charles Ludlam and Harvey Firestein, and people went on before me. But I think the success of Vampire Lesbians, you know, ran 5 years, and I think that certainly encouraged people to, you know, think of camp and drag as being a commercial possibility.
Do you think it's easier for you? You said you're more comfortable with your masculinity now. I mean, you've mm-hmm. been able to define what that is. It's not getting defined for you by the outside anymore.
I guess so, and for me, drag and assuming a female persona is not such a big deal. You know, I know there are great differences between the sexes, but in many ways there aren't. And at least for me, you know, I guess I have a slightly androgynous nature. And for me to go from male to female is sometimes just a question of how I cross my legs.
Now, your father, I understand, listened to a lot of opera. And did he sell opera records?
No, my father, he had a record store, it's true. And I guess he did sell some opera records, although I think of him mostly having, you know, rock and roll. But his store was in Yonkers, so it wasn't really an opera haven. But he wanted to be a singer. And so he performed with different sort of semi-professional and amateur opera companies in Westchester, where I was growing up. And so my bedtime stories were the plots of Verdi and Puccini operas. And sort of the first theater I saw were these productions that he would be in, where everything, including the chorus, were painted on the backdrop. And I just was enraptured by it, and I think that whole idea of sort of cheap theatricality stayed with me, and certainly you can see it in my plays.
Yeah, that's certainly the larger than life type of play.
Yeah, I love melodrama so much, and even as much as I love the comedy, and so my plays are often, you know, sort of revenge dramas, and if you took away the element of parody or the, you know, the shtick or the comedy, you know, the stories themselves are stories of passion and revenge and, you know, good triumphing, and there's often, you know, somebody either jumps out a window or is being murdered. I think somebody's been murdered in just about every play I've written. It's kind of odd, you know, and they're comedies. So I think that really shows that earliest interest was in melodrama.
So while your father was feeding you these stories of the great operas and thus kind of nourishing your interest in
melodrama. I had a very
melodrama.
Romantic sensibility. That was, by the time I'd say I was seven, my entire, everything that I'm interested in today was set.
But I bet your father was not very encouraging of your interest in acting out the parts of great actresses.
Oh, yeah, no, pas nécessaire. No, my father's so stage-struck.
Oh, really?
So stage-struck that I really could have done anything, and he would have been approved. And, I mean, just, I think when he sees my name on a marquee, I think he considered blot out the first name and imagine it's his own. I mean, he kind of lives vicariously through me, and I don't mind it at all, you know. So he lives in Florida now, but when he comes to see me in a show and, you know, I bring him backstage and he walks out on the stage, I can see him just sort of inhaling it in. He just loves it. And so, yeah, and so he's seen all my shows, and that doesn't bother him at all.
Charles Bush recorded in 1993. He's now performing his new show, Flipping My Wig, at the WPA Theater in Manhattan. Bush's suburban cabaret diva Miriam Passman would be happy to hear that the early recordings of Edith Piaf have just been reissued by DRG. Here's a 1938 recording by Piaf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Plus comment qu'on s'était rencontré. Je ne sais plus si c'est lui qui a parlé le premier, ou bien si c'était moi qu'avais fait les avances. Ça n'a pas d'importance. Tout ce que je veux me rappeler, c'est lui que mon cœur a choisi. Et quand il me tient contre lui, dans ses yeux caressants, je vois le ciel qui coule quand c'est beau, c'est épatant. Il a pas besoin de parler, il a rien qu'à me regarder. Et je suis à sa merci, je ne peux rien contre lui, car mon cœur l'a choisi. Je ne sais pas s'il est riche ou s'il a des défauts, mais de l'aimer comme je l'aime, un homme est toujours beau. Et quand on va danser, qu'il pose sur mes hanches ses belles mains si blanches, ça me fait froid dans le dos. C'est lui que mon cœur a choisi. Et quand il me tient contre lui, dans ses yeux caressants, je vois le ciel qui coule quand c'est beau, c'est épatant. Il a pas besoin de parler, il a rien qu'à me regarder. Et je suis à sa merci, je ne peux rien contre lui, car mon cœur l'a choisi. Je sais pas ce qui m'arrivera si ça durera longtemps, mais je me fiche du plus tard, je veux penser qu'au présent. En tout cas, il m'a dit qu'il m'aimerait toute la vie, que la vie sera jolie, s'il m'aime pour tout le temps.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Ghosts of Mississippi, a Rob Reiner film now at theaters everywhere. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a father's plan to replace his gay son with a straight one. The story of how one family was torn apart over a son's homosexuality.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. From time to time on Fresh Air, we showcase stories from the public radio series This American Life, produced at WBEZ in Chicago. Each week on the show, they choose a theme and ask writers, journalists, and performance artists to contribute related stories. Recently on This American Life, the theme was sissies. Here's the host and producer, Ira Glass.
What could be more horrible than the moment when you realize that everybody in the world can see some aspect of you? Something about you that you never even knew you were revealing, that you didn't want to reveal. Well, Mubarak was at a track meet. This was back in high school. He was at a track meet and he was setting up those runner's blocks that you use in track.
And I was, you know, sort of pampering my blocks, moving the blocks back and forth, like ever so slightly hair lengths. You know, testing out how they felt and standing up and putting my hands on my hip and, you know, putting my finger on my cheek and looking at it as if I was in deep thought and like bending down and probably even like dusting off the blocks. And what I didn't know at the time was there was the whole group of track members from the opposing team who were standing watching me. And laughing, they were like, you know, this big sissy is what they're putting up for us to beat.
Remember, please, high school. High school. Where in the hierarchy of put-downs, the worst thing you could call a boy was sissy. Mubarak won his match.
And the coach came up after I won, and he actually gave me this big hug. And he's like, that was great. And I was like, you know, thanks, but my time wasn't anything particularly better than before. So I kind of had this puzzled look in his face. He's like, that was great the way, you know, act like, the way you like psych those guys out by acting like a big sissy in front of your blocks and then like showing them. And as soon as he said that, it hit me like what had happened. And I was like, you know, I played along. Yeah, hey, well, good thing I thought of that.
So what happens when there's a part of yourself that everybody can see, that you can't change, that sets off a series of events that you cannot control? This next story is about a family that was ripped apart by something like that. It's a story that, weirdly enough, shares certain things with the story of Oedipus. The tragedy of the story of Oedipus, you may remember, is that a man marries his mother, kills his father, and then, of course, tears out his eyes when he realizes what he's done. It wasn't intentional. He didn't know. Well, this next story is also about a family where the son ends up with the mother, the father gone. And it's also a story where the tragedy is that it all happens without any of them really wanting it to happen this way. It's the ending they all wanted to avoid. This American Life producer Nancy Updike prepared the story of an American family and of what it means to be a man.
This story is like one of those Russian dolls where there's always a smaller one inside. The smallest doll, the core of the drama, is the fact that Mubarak, a childhood sissy, grew up to be a different kind of sissy than his father. His father is nerdy and bookish. Mubarak's gay. Everything around that core gets bigger and bigger until finally you can't believe the biggest and the smallest have anything to do with each other. The one is so bloated and the other so tiny. At the beginning of this story, Mubarak's parents are married and in love, and both prepare to live far from everything they know to be with each other. At the end of the story, they may still be in love, but they're divorced and an ocean apart and not speaking. And Mubarak is caring for his mother the way a husband might.
Okay, Margie Ruth.
I don't get too hot.
I'm not going to get too hot.
Mubarak starts Margie's shower, and he's holding on to her so she won't fall, and she's holding on to him, too. She's about 5 feet tall, naked and fragile-looking and very pale. He's dressed in jeans and a shirt that he knows are about to get really wet.
All right, lift your breast. Lift one at a time so I can wash under it.
Okay. Hey, Margie, was it hard the first time Mubarak gave you a shower?
I got embarrassed.
How did you get over being embarrassed?
I just, because it happens over and over and over again. And Mark is my son, you know.
He gets a washcloth in under her breasts, and she stands serenely, blinking in the water. It's a moment so intimate it's hard to watch, but then as he gets her out of the shower and is drying her off, there's another moment that makes the intimacy of everything before it seem completely beside the point and prettied up in comparison. He takes a baby wipe and wipes her butt for her.
Nobody's going to give me a shot today, are they?
No, we have to take some blood, though. We have to go to the lab, and they're going to take some blood.
Well, that's a shot.
It's not a shot. They're drawing blood.
Well, they put little
They stick you, but they're not giving you a shot. They're taking blood. There's a difference.
You ever tried it?
Margie's only 66, but in the last couple of years, she's had a heart attack and two small strokes, which paralyzed her right arm and affected her memory. It cuts in and out like faulty wiring. Sometimes she's talkative and remembers a lot. Sometimes she's not, and she doesn't.
Here, you know what? Lift your breast for me again so that we can make sure. You don't have a rash under there anymore, do you?
I don't think so.
Because we got to make sure it stays dry so it doesn't get a rash under there.
Mubarak, is this closer than you ever thought you'd get to an adult woman's body?
you could say that.
But this is the end of the story. This is today. Let's go back to the beginning. Mubarak's family didn't really notice that he was, as he tells it, a big sissy because they were all oddballs. No matter where they were living, at least one of them was always not quite fitting in. Margie's from Georgia and lived most of her married life either up north or in the Middle East. Mubarak's father, Sabr, is Palestinian, born in Jordan, but for most of the marriage, they all lived in a small town in Pennsylvania where he was a professor of civil engineering. Now, if Mubarak was a sissy and white, working-class Catholic Hershey, PA, Sabr was too.
We got a week off of school every year because so many people, so many boys went hunting, went deer hunting. And of course, you know, I didn't go hunting and I didn't play any, you know, football, and I didn't do all of those things that, you know, the boys in the neighborhood were supposed to do, especially hunting. Hunting was like, you know, a yardstick of when you reached manhood.
Sabr, meanwhile, to Mubarak's shame and horror, had to call in neighborhood dads to do simple mechanical tasks like unclogging a drain. And Margie was the one who hung their wedding pictures because Sabr claimed he didn't know how to hammer a nail.
No, Sabr didn't do any of that stuff. I mean, Sabr was always very formal. He always had a sport jacket. I remember, like, cutting grass was a big deal out there. Like, lawn care, like, how green and how even and how perfect was your yard. And then I remember Sabr was in the yard cutting the grass, and he was cutting the grass, and he had a sport coat and a tie on, which is funny, I mean, if you think about it.
Well, and why would he do it?
I mean, I think that came from the Middle East idea that if you are educated, that there's a certain position that you have in society, and that you should always look and act a certain way.
You can see why, in this atmosphere, Sabr at one point panicked and made Margie sign Mubarak up for Little League. To toughen him up, he told her. But mostly, Margie says, Sabr worshipped Mubarak. He adored him.
Mubarak this and Mubarak that and Mubarak the other, and everything he talked about was Mubarak. After he found out Bart was gay, he hardly ever said he wouldn't hardly even mention his name.
Margie was the one who made the phone call to Mubarak after finding a bunch of gay adult cards in his room. He was 20 years old and staying with friends in Germany at the time, on his way to a semester in England.
And it was the middle of the night. I don't remember if we were exactly in bed. And the mother came down and said in German to my friend, there's a phone call from America, and it's an emergency for your American friend. So I was all nervous, and I went upstairs, and it was Margie, and she was crying. She was hysterical. And she said, I said, Margie, what's wrong? And she said, you have to come home now.
And I said, why? What's wrong? And she just kept repeating, you have to come home now. And I kept trying to get out of her what was wrong. So she finally said, we found a good hospital in Tennessee that can cure you. And then I knew what was wrong. And of course, I told her that I wasn't coming home until the end of the semester, and I would see her in January. And I think I hung up right away.
We're listening to a story produced for the public radio series This American Life. We'll get back to it after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's continue with the story of Mubarak and how his homosexuality broke up his family. The story was produced by Nancy Updike for the public radio series This American Life for their edition on Sissies.
This was the beginning of their world starting to shift and become something else. Sabir blamed Margie for Mubarak being gay. Sabir, who never raised his voice before, would pound the table and say Mubarak was gay because he's a mama's boy.
I didn't think I'd married the same person at those times. Used to be jolly and gay and cheerful and tell jokes. I didn't know him anymore. I guess he didn't know me either.
He was in such bad shape that he had taken off time from the university. I think he took a whole semester off from teaching at the university. He was so bad at one point, he would sit and, like, stare into space and not respond to conversations and questions. And they had, like, home health care, like an IV for him at home because he wouldn't eat.
When Mubarak came home around Christmas, they all sat down at the kitchen table for a family meeting.
Margie didn't say hardly anything the whole time. And neither did I, actually. Sabir did most of the talking. And he said, basically, he started with, you know, you're our son and we love you, but this is wrong and this is an illness and there are doctors, you know, I've looked into it and there are doctors who say that if you just try, if you get help, that you can change, you know.
Did he say the word homosexual?
Oh, God, no, he would never say that. He would say, your condition or your problem, or your situation. He would never say the word gay or homosexual, ever, ever, ever. Like, even in the years after that, he never, ever said that word.
The biggest problem with Mubarak being gay was that he would never have children. He would never have a son to carry on the family name, as Sabir had done, and as Sabir's father had done. This was Mubarak's obligation. After a long argument, the last thing Sabir said to Mubarak was this.
I remember he said, he looked at me and he said, I will sell all the land in Palestine to raise the money to send you to a doctor if you ever decide that you would go. And that's if you being Palestinian and understanding how important land is, I mean, land is identity, it's a future, it's the past, it's everything. And for Sabir to say that he would sell all of his land showed that this was really the top priority in his whole life.
For 2 years, nothing changed. Mubarak stayed in school and kept being gay. Sabir stayed depressed and wrote Mubarak long letters saying he loved Mubarak, but Mubarak was sick and he owed it to Sabir to get help. Margie quietly began flooding Mubarak's college mailbox with condoms. Then Margie and Sabir moved back to the Middle East, as they'd always planned to do when Sabir retired. He was 65, she was 59. 6 months later, everything shifted again. The family mutated again, becoming more like what it would soon be and less like it had been before. It started with another phone call to Mubarak.
Well,
I mean, the way I first found out about it was I got a telephone call one afternoon from Margie. And she said, "Honey, do you think I could come live with you?" And I was, I didn't know what she was talking about. I said, "Margie, what are you talking about?" She said, "Do you think I could come live with you?" And then she told me that she and Saber were getting divorced because he was going to marry another woman and have another son.
In fact, divorce wasn't even what Saber wanted. At first, he asked Margie if she would be his partner in what he called
joint venture. I want you to help me find a young lady you think you can get along with. I said, "What?"
And he said, "I want to marry another woman and have a baby."
I said, "Okay, Saber, you better find one you think you can get along with, because I'm not going to be here."
And then, you know, she went through that was plan A, and the plan B was having another wife at a different apartment. And then plan C was him getting married in the West Bank, just going down there a couple weeks a year, and then basically living with Margie and Jordan. And her response to that was always my favorite. That's when she asked him. She said, "Okay, that's fine, as long as I can have a
boyfriend." He said, "Why?" I said, "So when you ask me what I've been doing, I'll tell you the same thing you've been doing while you were over there." He didn't appreciate that either.
And I remember Saber wrote me a very, very long letter explaining what he was doing and why he was doing it and how he had been forced into doing this, because for years he had been asking me to go get help and I was just ignoring him. And he felt that it was his, since I was not going to have a son to carry on the family name, that the responsibility of making sure that the family name survived suddenly became his again, and this was the only way he could see to do it. And he was very heavy on the, "This is your fault. You're doing this to Margie, not me." The other thing that was really strange was he spent pages saying, you know, your mother is being very closed-minded about all of this. Try to help me convince her to stay here. She doesn't have to leave. I don't want her to leave.
So Saber divorced Margie, telling her every day until she left that he loved her and didn't want her to leave. And she got on the plane and began the life she's pretty much living now. From that point on, instead of a husband, she would have a son. And from the moment the plane touched down, he treated her the way you'd want your husband to treat you.
I'll never forget when I came back getting off the plane. You know, we got through customs and all that stuff. I saw this great big bunch of flowers somebody was holding way up in that beautiful, beautiful bunch of flowers. And I said, "Somebody is certainly going to get to myself a beautiful bouquet of flowers." And guess who that was?
Well, any guesses? Margie moved into Mubarak's graduate school apartment, which, by the way, was at the same university where Saber had taught. In her old life, she'd been supported by one man, her husband, the professor. In her new life, she was surrounded by a whole sissy entourage. Mubarak's friends were always coming in and whisking her away to the orchestra, to plays. They adored her. She still cried every day, many times a day, for the first few months. And every day, she got at least one letter from Saber, sometimes two. Finally, one day, the letter that came from Saber said he'd gotten married. Mubarak, not knowing what was in the letter, gave it to Margie and went to his room.
We came back out. I mean, it was 5 or 10 minutes later, and she was still sitting there, but she had a funny look on her face. So I said, "Are you okay?" And she started saying things like, "Please don't hurt me, please don't hurt me," and crying. I'm like, "Margie, what are you talking about? Don't come any closer, don't come any closer, don't hurt me." And she didn't know who I was. She didn't know who she was.
Just went out of it.
Her amnesia, Mubarak calls it a vacation from the bad news, lasted several days.
We're listening to a story produced for the public radio series This American Life. We'll get back to it after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's continue with the story of Mubarak and his mother, Margie. It was produced for the public radio series This American Life by Nancy Updike.
One, two, three.
There you go. It's a good thing for
me. We're in Margie's cardiologist's office, and she's about to surprise me. On the last day I spend with Margie and Mubarak, she suddenly murmurs that she wishes Mubarak had gotten married.
Lou, I wish you would have married.
You wish Mubarak would have married?
Mm-hmm.
Who?
Mark Stoner.
Now, most mothers who say, oh, I wish my gay son had gotten married, and you ask them who, they don't say a man. There is
Mark Stoner.
So you don't wish Mubarak had married any girl that you know?
Mm-mm. Wish he'd have married Mark Stoner, because he was a nice guy, and he loved Mubarak a lot.
Even after all the time I'd spent with her, I had completely expected her to say a woman's name. Because even though it's common when men come out as gay for their mothers to be more accepting than their fathers, there are usually at least some pretty clear limits for the mothers, too. Certain ways that they're used to seeing the world and just can't give up. But Margie's world and Mubarak's are not really separate, as they are for most gay people and their parents. Mubarak is really glad she's here. He says it all the time. And he spends a lot of time with Margie. Willingly, happily. He's the only person I know who seems as unambivalent in his love for his mother as she is in her love for him. Every once in a while, he talks about something I know he thinks about a lot, which is that this is the end of Margie's life, and he's grateful that she's spending it here, where he can be with her.
Okay. Margie?
Mm?
Are you okay?
Mm-hmm.
You're like wobbling back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Margie? Margie? Margie, talk to me.
What is it, Barky?
What's happening?
While I was Look taping, Margie had what seemed to be a small stroke.
Margie? Margie? Margie?
Do you want me to call 911, Mubarak?
It all happened in about 2 minutes. Yeah. And when it was over, Margie seemed fine, although disoriented and tired. She couldn't really remember what had happened. We were more shaken than she was. Mubarak and I talked in the kitchen afterward while he made Margie some tea.
It was really scary.
It was so frightening. Because, you know, it's so scary when you go to the hospital. And I remember the first time I went, and she had congestive heart failure. And you don't know what that means. You know, you hear heart failure and you panic. And then I remember the other two times going into the hospital and thinking it should be easier this time. But every time it happens, it gets scarier because you think you're one step closer to something really awful happening. I'm going to be a mess whenever anything really serious happens. We just did that because we knew you were going to be tape recording today. I'm like, Margie, you can have a little heart failure this afternoon.
Just do what you can. I mean,
I'm so scared all the time.
P.S. It might not be clear from this story, but I think Margie really loved Sauber. I think he really loved her. We saw it clear as day in the pages of her wedding scrapbook. She turns to a picture from her wedding day. Sauber's embracing Margie, and both their eyes are closed. They're smiling. They look completely happy, probably not even aware the picture is being taken.
What were you thinking right at that moment when that was happening?
I got that man. He's mine now. My mother had told me, when you find the right one, you know it. And I did. Well, I thought he was the right one. Turned out he wasn't. I never did find the right one.
The story of Mubarak and his mother Margie was produced by Nancy Updike for the public radio program This American Life, which we often showcase on Fresh Air. This American Life is produced at WBEZ in Chicago by Ira Glass. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Alan, too, directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Cherie Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.